All right, so hanging on, so many people already. I'll try and get you an open line if you're trying to get through right now. Chances are it's already locked, but we're taking lots of questions for Peter Lavenda. The new book is called Ratline. It's about Hitler's escape. Poisonous Unicorn tweeted me at Deacon Punnett at Twitter, said, please ask about Hitler's drug dependency and how this new quote-unquote doctor was able to satisfy those addictions. Thanks. It's an excellent question. And it goes back to how mistreated Hitler had been, perhaps even we should use the word maltreated, during World War II. Not that it breaks my heart to think they were pumping him full of bizarre stuff, but it's a very interesting question with great detail in Ratline. We'll get back to you with all of your questions, too. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. So, Peter, we'll start with that question that somebody tweeted me at Deacon Punnett, which is just that Adolf Hitler was being treated by some quack doctors in Nazi Germany. He'd become addicted to all sorts of things. What happened to that once he went along the rat line?
Well, it's a good question. His quack doctor, most famously, was Dr. Morell. And he had gone to Morell long ago, long before the war, for Morell's specialty, which was venereal disease. So we don't know if Hitler actually was suffering from venereal disease or not. It seems that maybe he wasn't, but he had gone to Morell anyway in that capacity. And from then on, Morell became his personal physician. But Morell was a quack. He was a guy who owned shares in various pharmaceutical companies that was making, you know, patent medicines, weird stuff. And he kept Hitler on a bizarre regimen of amphetamines, of cocaine, of aconite, a deadly nightshade, you know, belladonna, all sorts of poisons, strychnine and all sorts of things, arsenic, all for various real and imagined illnesses that Hitler was supposedly had. The interesting thing is that before the end of the war, about a week or 2 weeks before April 30th, when Hitler was supposedly committing suicide, he sends Dr. Morell away. He basically fires him from the bunker. So Morell leaves. Now, Morell was his, according to all accounts, Morell was his connection. I mean, Morell was the guy getting him all the drugs. And all of these drugs were, according to the story, stuff that Hitler was addicted to. But Morell leaves. And it's possible that all of the stuff that he was giving Hitler, of course, Hitler was no longer taking. If Hitler had been sick, if Hitler had been taking all of this stuff, he probably would have improved. His health would have improved after Morell had left. He would stop taking all of this other stuff. So I don't know if he was truly addicted to these drugs. And if he was, posing as a doctor might have given him the ability to keep a ready supply.
John is in Lima, Ohio, on Coast to Coast for Peter Lavenda. John, what would it take to convince you that Adolf Hitler survived the war and lived out his natural life in Asia, in Indonesia?
Actually, it's my understanding that the one person that really believed that Adolf Hitler was still alive was Joseph Stalin.
We talked about that very early on, so let's readdress that.
Yes, Stalin did believe it. I mean, the CIA tried to say it was disinformation, but everything that we know about Stalin and the way the KGB was desperate to prove that Hitler was dead showed that Stalin truly did believe that Hitler had survived. He wasn't alone in this. A lot of people in Europe believe that Hitler had escaped. A lot of Hitler's former deputies believe that Hitler had escaped and said so to the press. There was a vast underground complex being built near Salzburg in Austria, where this story really begins, called the National Redoubt. And that's where it was believed the Nazis would try to fight a last-ditch stand against the Allies, was in this area. Hanna Reich, the pilot, the famous pilot that Hitler loved, flew out of Berlin a day or two before the fall. And she claimed to her interrogators when she was captured by the Allies that the redoubt really existed and that the Nazi high command was still talking about it a couple of days before the end. So there's a lot of declassified files that have recently come out that tend to support the idea that there was an escape platform having been constructed in Austria, which is where the story begins with Dr. Puch, that it was there near Berchtesgaden where Hitler's retreat was, and that's what Stalin was fearful of. Part of the problem for Stalin was that that section was in the American and English sector not in the Russian sector. So there was this fight over trying to get access to that. Stalin believed that what had happened was we had captured Hitler and were protecting him to use him and his forces in, of course, an anti-communist crusade. As we all know, the anti-communist crusade did take place in Latin America, in Europe, in Asia, everywhere. There was an anti-communist crusade led in many cases by former Nazis. So his fear was not that far-fetched.
I'm going to take a process moment here. Were you even aware of that during part of your answer, I had dropped off completely off the air?
No.
Okay, good. So here, I'm just going to explain something in case it should come up again for the rest of this hour. Briefly, the line was disconnected between here and the studio. For some reason, we've had problems with these lines tonight. As it is, I'm sort of flying on one engine. We usually have a main line and a backup, but we can't get the backup to work this morning. So I'm going with just the one line. Should it happen again, Peter, I hereby deputize you to keep running the show until I can get back. Okay?
Very good. No problem.
Okay, so suddenly if you come to the end of an answer and I'm not there, wing it. Ed is in Allentown on Coast to Coast. Ed?
Hi, Ian.
How are you?
Hi. Hello, Peter Levin. Ian, it's great to hear your voice.
Thank
you. I wish
you
could do more shows. I hope your TMJ is better. And I recommend acupuncture. It really works.
Well, I don't have TMJ, but I will, acupuncture is still something that I will be experimenting with in the future. So thank you.
You don't feel anything.
That's good to know. Okay. But you had a question about Adolf Hitler and whether or not he was able to escape to Indonesia.
Right. I was wondering if Peter Lavenda also knew about Eichmann, who designed the Holocaust, to his right-hand man, Peter Wisselsaney, gave a deposition at the Nuremberg trials that the Islamic Mufti leader helped instigate the Holocaust and even made trips to Auschwitz to see the progress. And Hitler felt an empathy with the Mufti, who was very close to him, and also shared that he would convert to Islam. And also that it sounds a lot like the Leon Uris novel, QB7, with the Nazi doctor going to a third world country, trying to do good deeds and pretend he was someone else.
I don't know if he did good deeds or not, but go ahead, Peter.
I just tried to do good deeds, I meant.
Yeah.
But I was wondering if Peter knew about that, and maybe he should write a book about that, too.
Well, I'll tell you, there was a very well-reported comment that Hitler made to Martin Bormann, and I use that quotation in the Holy Alliance, in which Hitler tells Bormann, mark my words, Bormann, I'm going to become very religious. And it's a very cynical statement by Hitler, saying in effect that religion was going to be useful to him to help promote his operation, his program. He was close to the Grand Mufti, as the photographs in the book will show. I mean, here's a guy who raised an army for Hitler. So, you know, there was this connection. And I think that there was this idea that maybe Islam was more congenial to at least part of the program. Remember, the Nazis felt that the Arabs and the Jews were the same. They were Semites. They were subhuman as far as the Nazi ideology was concerned. Yet, so many Nazis after the war, including several famous ideologues of the Nazi Party, converted to Islam and lived out their days in the Middle East. So Hitler would not have been the first, you know, to have taken that route. So it is conceivable. It is possible that this happened. There was a connection. The Grand Mufti definitely wanted to be on Hitler's side to get rid of the British and the French out of the Middle East. That was his immediate concern. So, you know, yeah, there's a possibility. There's a possibility, definitely, that we know that some Nazis did convert to Islam. It's mentioned in my book. Their names are there.
Right.
Famous people. So, you know, yeah. Why not?
But it's also very possible, and we know that many of the escaping Nazis disguise themselves as Catholic priests.
Well, that's the other thing. You know, Draganovich, the Catholic Monsignor, was by no means the only Catholic priest involved in the monastery route and the rat lines. He had Bishop Alois Hudal on his side, a very prominent National Socialist and Catholic bishop, who wrote a book called The Foundations of National Socialism, and he gave an autographed copy to Adolf Hitler. There were cardinals, there were priests and bishops without number who were extremely sympathetic to the Nazi cause because of anti-communism. Perón typified in Argentina, this idea of a strong military leader who was both anti-communist and pro-Nazi and Roman Catholic, religiously Catholic. This was an idea that was being bruited about even before the war was over, that there had to be a united Christian Nazi front against communism. So, yeah, you know, religion played a very big part.
And people might grab the nearest disguise they could find, you know, whether that be a turban, whether that be, you know, a cassock, whatever it is that they could find, they would hide behind at the end of World War II. Andrew is in Los Angeles on Coast to Coast for Peter Lavenda, Ratline, the new book about the disappearance of Adolf Hitler. Andrew?
Yes. Welcome back, Hannah. It's really great to hear you. Peter, everything you say makes perfect sense. It's logical. It seems to resonate with the real possibility of truth. In fact, the question that I have is, Dr. Poit, the real Dr. Poit, are there any remaining photographs of the real doctor? And were any pictures, photographs taken of the alleged imposter, Hitler? And finally, if you can, did you come across any research about the possibility of a continuation of the agenda, the Nazi agenda, maybe having moved to Antarctica or other locations for a future third try?
A Fourth Reich.
Yeah, exactly, the Fourth Reich. Yes.
Hang on, Andrew. I'm gonna restate his questions here because I think it's really interesting. And I just, for people who may be coming in a little bit toward the end on this. So we have the story of a real guy named Dr. Poik, who we know a lot about up to 1945. Then we have the story of what we believe to be Adolf Hitler posing as Dr. Poik after 1945. So the question of what about photographs pre-1945 of the guy who was originally Dr. Poik, and then the photographs after 1945 of Adolf Hitler as Poik? That was the first question. Could you talk more about that?
Sure. The search for photographs, not just of Dr. Poik, but also Hella Poik, his wife, consumed a lot of time and energy on my side, and there doesn't seem to be anything in existence anywhere. And I've talked to researchers in Europe. I'm still in close contact with people. We're still following up the story as best we can, and we can't find anything. I mean, it seems incredible to me that there are no photographs of these two, the original Poik and Hella Poik. There's just nothing. Rudolf Poik, we have photographs of, her first husband. But after that, we've got nothing. We have nothing.
Well, and there's a weird little moment we should explain, is that she married two guys named Poik,
yeah,
right? So when you say Rudolf Poik, her first husband was named Rudolf Poik. He dies. Then she marries a second guy named Poik, which is also weird.
Well, it is. I mean, I searched records. I did the whole genealogy thing in Austria and Germany. It's a very rare name. So for her to meet two different guys and marry both of them, it strains credulity. So I don't know what that's all about, really. There's something going on there. I don't know what it is. But anyway, we don't have those photographs. What I do have, and which are in the book, are photographs of the Poik in Indonesia and his Indonesian wife. Those photographs are there. But as far as what these people looked like before the war, during the war, after the war, I got nothing. You know, there just doesn't seem to be any photographic evidence. And in fact, nobody will answer as far as the whereabouts of these people from either the Vienna Anthropological Society won't answer, the Rudolf Poik Institute. Everybody's giving me the runaround. Nobody will answer straight up, you know, where do these people go? What's the backstory? Who are they?
Right.
You know, what crime?
Where do they go after the war? Nobody seems to know.
No.
But there is a photo. There is an AB comparison for Andrew, to speak to Andrew's question, of a young, emaciated Adolf Hitler after World War One, very thin in World War One, and Adolf Hitler late in life as this guy Poik, and that's eerie.
Yes. One thing you'll notice if you study anthropology and ethnography is that the measurements of certain facial features don't change, even with plastic surgery. So the ear shapes and the jaw lines generally have a hard time changing. And if you compare those two photographs, you're going to see a very eerie resemblance between Adolf Hitler in the trenches in World War One and an emaciated Hitler, as I believe that he was in Indonesia in the 1960s. You're going to see a tremendous resemblance.
And then there was the Fourth Reich question.
Yes. Wow. Well, I sort of end the book with a discussion of that. There was definitely a Fourth Reich, as far as I'm concerned, because the Nazi networks existed for long after the war and continue to exist to this day. So, and they're not existing in the sense that it's just a bunch of guys meeting for coffee once in a while. I mean, they're involved in drug smuggling, human trafficking, political assassinations. Those records are there. Klaus Barbie ran the Secret Service for Bolivia for a long time. I mean, these people were very much involved in Operation Condor, assassinating communist leaders throughout Latin America and in Europe. So there's definitely a history of Fourth Reich activity. When you bring up Antarctica, it's a different story. I have my suspicions about Operation High Jump that we conducted. We know the Nazis were down there in 1938-39, dropping swastika flags all over Antarctica, claiming it for themselves. We know that we went to tremendous expense to send an entire naval expedition to Antarctica immediately after the war. And I've never been able to figure out a logical reason for doing that when we had just spent an enormous amount of treasure and blood in fighting wars on two fronts to then send an expedition to Antarctica of all places. So there might have been suspicion in the military that there was some sort of Nazi redoubt that was being established in Antarctica. That's something that I bring up, I mention, and I just don't know what to do with that information yet.
Love the fact that you did that, too. Dee Dee is in California. Again, we're talking about Ratline. I read it cover to cover. I read the footnotes. I read the author notes. I've read everything. This book was just great. Dee Dee, what would it take to convince you that Adolf Hitler survived World War II, lived a long natural life in Indonesia?
Oh, I absolutely believe it. I have no problem with that. But first of all, Ian, Deus te amat, and so do I, and so does Agnes Day.
I like that. Thank you.
Anyway, Peter, I wanted to ask you, do you know or have you seen or heard of the one thing that I can guarantee you Hitler did not take with him, and that was his personal grooming kit, which I happened to see and hold. It was the shape of and size of an attaché case. It was rimmed in silver. It had two clasps on it with AH over each one of them, the German eagle, the swastika underneath it. And when you opened it up, inside of it was his personal hat mirror, all his hairbrushes, his combs, the scissors he used to trim his mustache with.
How did you see this? Where did you see it, Dee Dee?
A friend of mine who is no longer on the planet used to be a consultant for World War II movies to make sure that all of the German officers' uniforms, sure, et cetera, were authentic and true. He also had a small shop on Hollywood Boulevard catering to the Hell's Angels crowd with the Iron Crosses, et cetera. But he was an avid collector, and this personal grooming kit was picked up by one of the soldiers who was the first into the bunkers and held in secret.
Very interesting. I love that story. I appreciate that. That'll take us to our second to last break, though, which I hate to think. We're running out of time with Peter Lavenda. So thank you, Dee Dee. We'll leave that there, and we'll get to your questions and comments for Peter Lavenda the last half of the last hour. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Got a whole half hour here with Peter Lavenda. Let's make it count. And thanks for keeping in touch through Deacon Punnett. It'll be a month before I'm back on again, but I'm already lining up guests for a month from tonight. Saw some really cool stuff online today. I try to, since I'm only on once a month now on Coast to Coast because of this horrendous ongoing case of tinnitus, which you can read more about if you go to coasttocoastam.com. You can click onto the article I wrote for Tinnitus Today magazine. Don't bother trying to find it on your newsstand, but you can read the article. They put up a special link for it at coasttocoastam.com, because I give a shout out to a Coastie, Mike in Santa Barbara, who is hugely helpful in an odd sort of way with this. Anyway, because I'm only on now once a month, I have to get it exactly right. I have to kind of get all the pieces in there that I want to get back on again. And that's why I'm with great care. I sometimes have to claim a guest before George Norrie or George Knapp or anybody else for that matter can schedule that guest. So today I was sending out some furious emails saying, I want to get this guest for next month. It's a little pathetic. But you can track it, because at Deacon Punnett, I will often post the guests I'm working on and, of course, the guests we get. And I was very excited about Peter Lavenda. I was telling everybody about it weeks ago. And I look forward to you getting on with him coming up next. You've gotten the numbers. We'll grab it coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, I love the questions from people who have obviously been following Peter Lavenda's work over the year. We pick it up with Anna in Glenwood Springs, Colorado on Coast to Coast. The book is Ratline, about the disappearance of Adolf Hitler after World War II. Anna?
Hi, good morning. It's actually a great honor to be on here. I've been listening to Post since I can remember. I just had a question. I'm actually amazed at everything that I'm hearing, simply because I just finished reading a biography on Adolf Hitler, and I'm beginning to wonder if it wasn't some kind of a cover-up, because at the end of this biography, it discussed how Adolf was actually shot and he died. And now I'm beginning to wonder if it was in fact a cover-up and they actually had him in hiding and they knew that he was still alive. What's your perspective on that?
Can I, before Peter answers, can I ask, in the book you were reading, which way did they say that he had shot himself?
No, they said that he died from a gunshot wound.
That somebody else shot him?
Yes. That's why I'm like, I'm really set back by reading and hearing, because number one, I really believe, you know, that there are government cover ups. You know, and I do believe that they hide people.
Okay. Yeah, well, we know they did that. I mean, that's not even something you have to wonder about. I mean, there's proof of that. Peter, jump in here and help out.
Sure. I think it's possible that the book you're referring to is by Hugh Thomas. He wrote a book called The Murder of Adolf Hitler, where he dissected all the forensic evidence, came up to the same conclusion that the bodies that they found were not Hitler and Eva Braun. But his point of view was that Hitler was murdered, basically, and that body was destroyed so that no one would find the evidence that Hitler had been murdered. He also believed that Eva Braun escaped, that she was allowed to escape. So for some reason, he believed Eva Braun escaped, but he didn't believe that Hitler had escaped. He believed Hitler had been murdered. So that's one of the theories that has been put forward. But Hugh Thomas's work is very valuable because he analyzes the forensic evidence really step by step and shows how false it all was. So I've heard the rumor that he was murdered, but I think that Thomas, in this case, got it almost 100% right. He just believed that Hitler had been shot, had been murdered, as opposed to taking his own life. But he did believe Eva Braun escaped.
Anna, was that the book you were reading?
I don't remember who the author was, but okay. it was a pretty big book, and it took me a while to read it.
Okay. Well, good. I'm glad
It was truly an honor to
great
talk to you guys.
Terrific to have you on. Thank you, Anna. I appreciate that. Honestly, I'm just, if we weren't trying to get on so many other people, we'd take a little more time. But Carl is in Illinois, and he's been hanging on for a while on Coast to Coast. Carl?
Yes. Peter, I grew up, I'm almost 70 years old, but I grew up studying World War II, and I had a lot of, my uncles was in World War II, and we had a lot of friends that were in the front, and later I belong to this Shark Hunters International group.
I know them. Yep.
And we went over to Germany there, but he did a deal on Hitler getting down to South America. Harry Cooper did, and I talked to a lot of veterans, including the veterans that was in the government under Danitz at the end of the war. And I also talked to a guy by the name, I think his name was Otto Skorzeny, and then the guy that was Leon DeGrill, which was the guy that was the high decorated guy that Hitler said if he had a son, he'd want him to be like him. And he told me that he had gotten out through that deal, but either through the submarine, but he died somewhere in down there in Argentina. And I asked him what year that the different guys said that he died, and they said around 62. And I said, did they have a grave or anything? And they said, no. No one's to ever know where he was buried, because they were afraid that if the Mossad found out about it, they were going to come there and dig up the place, and nobody wanted to know exactly what year and what time of the month that he had died down there in Argentina.
All right, Peter?
Hold on, I got one more thing to say. He said that a lot of things that were tortured on all these guys in Nuremberg, and I'm beginning to question how much stuff, including the war criminals trial at Nuremberg. When I was there, I talked to the chief guy that was the historical guy, and I said, that my uncle liberated one of them camps, and I said the concentration camps where they did all this. He was a German, but he was not a white guy. But he said he's been there for 30 some years and did all. And he said that those guys and all the information they have at Nuremberg was a lie. And he said them guys was tortured, and all the documents are frozen that you can't get in any records.
Okay.
This guy told me right there at Nuremberg that one of the guys that interviewed us. Well, anyhow, when I got back, I couldn't believe it. But they
you've got a lot of things out here, and I want to make sure we have time for Peter to address them. So keep going. Go ahead, Peter.
Okay. The first place, I'm very aware of Shark Hunters. Great operation. These guys go all over the place. They specialize in the U-boat stuff and in the submarine stuff, but of course also the Hitler sightings and the Hitler stuff in South America. So there are a bunch of interesting guys. And of course, De Grel, the famous Belgian fascist leader, did state that Hitler had escaped. So many of the things that Carl's talking about, I did come across, and some of them I mentioned in Ratline. Some of the rumors about the Hitler escaping and all this other information that he talked about. As far as Nuremberg is concerned, I have my doubts that they were tortured and that, all of that. I mean, I do doubt that end of the story. But one thing I've learned at this point in my life is that, things that I hold dear, I think I know, I don't necessarily know. So I'll leave that open.
Although it's fair to say that the Soviets tortured a lot of them, and
absolutely.
And so the fact that in a way that could be a little conflation that the Nazis that were tortured by the Soviets, they gave all sorts of different versions of what happened to Adolf Hitler, as you chronicle in the book. And as for the submarine to Argentina story, somebody even tweeted about that. So can you address that story?
Sure. In the first place, one thing that's important to realize is that there were a lot of submarines at sea when the war ended. Some of them took months before they surrendered themselves, before they gave themselves up. And Argentina was a famous place for that activity. So you had a couple of famous U-boats that wound up in Argentina months after the end of the war. There's been a mystery about one of those U-boats, the belief that it had stopped at some place along the coast of Argentina, north of Buenos Aires, perhaps offloaded some people and some documents, perhaps some other material, and then the crew then finally surrendered in Buenos Aires. So there's been a lot of rumors like that. And one thing I talk about in the book is the fact that U-boat traffic made it as far as Indonesia, that it's a documented fact that the Nazis had U-boat bases in Indonesia and in Singapore and in Malaysia during the war. When the British bombed them out of Malaya, then they wound up in Indonesia. So there were Nazi U-boat captains in Indonesia during the war. It's a fascinating story, one that I didn't know until I started this research. So the U-boat thing is fascinating because the U-boats that went to Indonesia were outfitted as cargo submarines. They were not there for fighting necessarily, but for transporting people and war material to the Japanese in return for war material the Japanese were giving to the Nazis. It's the only time during the war that the Nazis and the Japanese actually worked and cooperated together face-to-face, whereas those U-boat bases in Indonesia. So when we're talking about missing gold, missing art treasures, that sort of thing, we can look further afield than we have. We can look as far away as Indonesia and the Philippines for some of that gold that wound up after the war.
Jeremiah is in Pueblo, Colorado, on Coast to Coast for Peter Lavenda, the author of Ratline. Jeremiah?
Good evening, gentlemen. How are you?
Good. Terrific. Go for it.
Good. I got a question. You mentioned something about a gentleman out of Connecticut, I believe, who actually took a piece of the skull and confirmed that it didn't match with Eva Braun or Hitler. And I can understand how if you have the entire skull, you see the fusion of the skull and everything like that, you can determine sex and age and whatnot. But how can you do that with just a small piece of the skull?
Well, they had the archaeologist investigated the skull in Moscow, and what you said is exactly correct. Fusion of the plates and everything else, he was able to determine that this was not a male and it was not the right age to be Hitler or Eva Braun. But the piece that he took back was worked on chemically in the laboratory back in Connecticut, not necessarily for genetic material, because we don't have legally genetic material from Hitler or Hitler's family. But they were able to determine the sex of the skull. They're able to determine the age of the skull from the material that was taken back and analyzed chemically.
Ken is in Cocoa Beach, Florida, on Coast to Coast, east of the Rockies, for Peter Lavenda. Ken?
Hi. I spent a lot of time in Germany. I read a lot of books, and it never rang true to me that these guys were crazy enough to sit there in the face of the Soviets, and if they were that crazy, to off themselves. But I do have one question. What was his converted name in Islam, and was that Islamic name on the graves? And
if
not, why not?
That's good.
That's a very good question. His name was Abdul Kohar, the son of the conqueror, or the follower of the conqueror. And the name does not appear on his tombstone. That's the other anomaly. The name that's on the tombstone is his European name, Georg Anton Puch. So that's another anomaly. We don't know why, because he had converted, and according to his wife, his Indonesian wife, he was a practicing Muslim in the last year or two of his life. Why they would not have put that on the tombstone is also a mystery. He's buried in an Islamic cemetery, not in a multi-denominational cemetery, but in a Muslim cemetery. So that's another anomaly.
It's still fascinating to me that, and you tell the story so well at the beginning of the book, is you're making your way to this grave, and you're actually a little nervy about, like, what's going to happen. I mean, you're not exactly sure how they're going to receive this, you know, you, sure, a visitor, and somebody else with a camera and the whole bit. And that when you get there, I mean, the joke's on you a little bit, because the guy just looks there and points at us, is Hitler? Yeah. He was on to you all along. I just totally love that. Makes you wonder who else has come and gone before you ever got there. John is in Long Beach, California, on Coast to Coast, on a wild card line for Peter Lavenda, the author of Ratline. John?
Real quick, Ian, about tinnitus. I don't have it, but I had a rotating electric alarm clock next to me, and I, like, when I slept like 15 years, and it made a little, every time I turned a minute, it made a little cranking sound, and when it finally broke, I'd be laying there at night, and I'd still hear that cranking sound. I don't know, it's in my ear. It made it burn itself into my ear. My kind of tinnitus. But anyway, I want to ask you real quick. If you see the pictures of Hitler, you know, the famous one of him looking at the boy army, the child right, army that was left, he looks like he's so in such bad health at that time. It's hard for me to conceive that maybe he got out, but it's hard for me to conceive that he would live 17 more years or whatever it was, you know, because he was in such poor health at age 56 that, you know, it seems like he would have died anyway. You know, I'm just asking that question.
No, it's a good question. And, you know, quite frankly, I hate to sound so weird by saying this, but We know for a fact, because the Russians found them and photographed them, that Hitler had a number of doubles at the end. He had a number of doubles through his entire life. So we don't know if that's Hitler in that film footage and in that photograph or not in the first place. In the second place, let's say it is Hitler. He looks old, and he looks a bit infirm, and probably that's why it took him a couple of years to get out of Europe and make it over to Argentina. We don't know how he managed to survive during that time, but according to the diary, they were living in Salzburg, and I think that was enough time for him to recuperate to the point where they could make that trip, because they left a little bit late. They left by 1951, so it's a couple of years after the end of the war. But he left the same year that Klaus Barbie did, so they were still running agents, running Nazis, rather, out of Europe into South America at the time. So possibly, you know, the couple of years away from Dr. Morell did him wonders.
Yeah, I mean, once you get all that crap out of his system, who knows, you know? Yeah. I mean, that all of that could have just been caused, all of the weight gain, all of that other stuff. I mean, he looked really paunchy and everything, but I don't know. I think we've all known somebody who was getting the wrong medicine for something. It was only making their life worse. When they got the right medicine, suddenly they got all healthy again. Charles is in L.A. on Coast to Coast for Peter Lavenda, author of Ratline. We don't have much time here, Charles, but I think we can work in. Yep.
When Peter visited the grave as a relative, and they pointed, you know, and said that it was Hitler, how did you ever find out how they all seemed to know that that was Hitler? And what happened to the woman, the second wife?
Well, the second wife, as far as I know, is still alive. She's living in the town of Bandung in Indonesia.
Uh-huh.
It's been very difficult to get to her. She's living in what is essentially a military compound.
Oh.
So she's under very serious protection there in the first place. In the second place, I believe that they knew or they suspected it was Hitler because of all the people who had been there before me who were paying their respects at the gravesite. And I think the rumor started to spread. And probably the article published back in the 80s, that circulated as well.
Uh-huh.
So people were talking about it. And there was a prince of Solo in Indonesia who wrote a pamphlet on this subject a couple of years ago. And he talked about his belief as to whether or not this was Hitler. He believed it was Hitler. He got a lot of his facts wrong, which I had to deconstruct along the way. But for the most part, he was under the assumption that it was Hitler, too. So the Indonesians are kind of aware of the story.
Ross, we're going to have to make you super quick if we're going to get you in here, okay? Because the music is already rolling behind us. So quick question for Peter Lavenda, Ross.
Yes, Trudel Jung, who was Hitler's secretary, there's been a program I watched on the Hitler Channel, the History Channel.
No, it's the Hitler Channel. I'm with you 100%.
Yeah, the Hitler Channel. But anyway, she said that she, I believe, was in the next room when Hitler and Eva shot themselves and saw the bodies being carried out. I just wondered how this was. The screener said this was addressed early in the program.
Yeah, so we got like 20 seconds left to go. Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, there's just so many eyewitness accounts, and they've been around for a while, and they're, as I say, contradictory. So I don't give her any more or less credence than I would give any of the other witnesses.
Although it's interesting, isn't it, that so many people within a few feet of the same incident tell their story with such sincerity and credibility. The rest will just have to refer you to the book. It's so worth it. It's brand new. You're going to love it. Like me, I think you'll finish it cover to cover. Ratline, Soviet Spies, Nazi Priests, and the Disappearance of Adolf Hitler. It's a home run, Peter Lavenda.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Look forward to having you back when you work on your latest again. So toddle off, get to work on it. I need another good read, okay? I was kind of bummed when I got to the end of the book. I had been enjoying it so much. We'll talk to you all in a month. Deus tamat, and I do too. Thanks, George, for everything.